Well, I trust you've had a good day. The question that is the topic of discussion tonight is very easily understood. Three words. Are you ready? Are you ready? Some time ago, I did a study of Ecclesiastes. It's a fascinating book. The author, I believe, was Solomon. My personal belief is that it was probably the last thing that he wrote because he actually seems to write about his experiences over time. He was a man who had everything that a man could desire and more. And yet he found it all, quite frankly, to be lacking. It did not matter what he desired. He could possess it, but his life still seemed empty. Didn't matter how many people he could rule over, how much power he could exert at the end of the day. His life still seemed empty. He ultimately reached the conclusion that the whole of man is to fear God and keep his commandments, and then acknowledge that a time was coming when man will be held accountable. Every work will be brought into judgment with every secret thing. And when that day comes, I can assure you that what will be uppermost on all our minds is our preparation for that day, and whether or not we actually did our duty, honored our Creator, walked in the steps of His Son, our Savior, and lived life so that others could see a reflection of Him in our lives every day. The world would have us to believe, quite frankly, that life is about riches, position, power, pleasure, and fame. But none of these things actually deliver. I've had people tell me on more than one occasion, if I just had more money, I would be happy. But my response is always, if you're not happy with what you have, you won't be happy with more of it. I've had the privilege or the burden of knowing in my life some very successful people from the world standards. They've done quite well financially, but they were often heartbroken and sometimes literally broken men. I will never forget seated across the desk from one of the most successful men from worldly standards I've known. It was about this time of year his accountant had just delivered his income tax forms. I'm not exaggerating, a stack this big. It seemed like everything he touched, he succeeded in. But the tears are streaming down his cheeks. His heart is broken because his family was in shambles. And that's something money can't fix. And his response to me was, I have been so busy providing everything they wanted that I forgot to give them what they needed. A godly example. Time. Involvement in their lives. Being there, showing up, letting them know that they mattered. But their conclusion was that in his life, what mattered was money. He did well. But I think if he were alive today, he'd tell you he failed. Historically, there are some really tragic stories that can be told. Two names that are recognizable, I think, almost universally, Cleopatra and Adolf Hitler. Two characters of history who ruled their worlds, who at one time appeared to have everything, but both took their own lives. Ernest Hemingway, one July morning in 1961, took his own life. Robin Williams, considered a comedy genius, hung himself in 2014. Ladies, June 5th, 2018, Kate Spade, a famous fashion designer, was found hanging in her New York apartment, dead by her own hand, discovered by her maid. She was just 55. I wouldn't recognize that name, but my wife has a Kate Spade purse that I think she got at Goodwill, because I know I didn't buy it. And she's too tight to buy it for herself. I just wrap your head around that for a moment. These are people, by and large, with the exception of Adolf Hitler, that were admired, respected, considered to be highly successful people. And they were financially, but their lives were clearly in shambles. Men long for happiness, to live fulfilling and meaningful lives. And I want you to know that it's possible to be happy, to live a meaningful, fulfilling, productive life. But not if you listen to the world. It can only happen when you listen to God and prioritize or get your life in order. And that seems such a simple thing to say, you would expect people to embrace it and act upon it immediately. But it's not the case. And it really is a little startling from my perspective again. I have noticed over the years that any announcement of an impending snowstorm sends people to the market almost immediately. And before you know it, the bread and milk and eggs are gone. But I can't remember in my lifetime a single snowstorm that wasn't addressed within 24 or 48 hours and the roads were clear and you could go anywhere you wanted. I know there have been exceptions. I was born in 51. I have heard almost from the day I was born about the big snow that came in November of 1950 in our area of the country. Over there in the backwoods of West Virginia, they got between 36 and 42 inches, and they were 2 weeks getting out in the country where my family lived, and they shoveled themselves out. Granted, it's a dead-end road, as narrow almost as the aisle here between the two sets of pews. If you met somebody, somebody had to back up for a long ways before you could pass. I can't remember that in my lifetime happening. I can remember some substantial snows, not 36 to 42 inches, 18, 20, 22. And the roads are cleared rather quickly, and life gets back to normal. But the people still rush to the store because they have to have bread, eggs, and milk. And there may be others, Dr. Pepper, of course. I don't drink soft drinks anymore, but when I did, that was my beverage of choice. My wife tells me it tastes like cough syrup, but that's her opinion. I know people who, when they vacation, they plan and prepare and actually pack weeks in advance. And I have no problem with that, but it seems to me at least that facing eternity is a little more important than getting ready for a vacation. Maybe that's just me. A lot of parents start planning for their children's education when they bring them home from the hospital. I know that's the case with my children and thus my grandchildren. College is expensive. If they're going to go, somebody's got to pay. And contrary to what it seems a lot of people think, I shouldn't be paying for your children and your grandchildren. That's just not my job. The government shouldn't be paying for your children and my children with our money collectively. We have an individual responsibility, and people are starting to come around to that, and so they begin to prepare. We are bombarded, it seems to me, with all kinds of messages about the importance of planning and preparing for retirement. I used to get really irritated when I would watch television, and I can't remember the company because I just tried to block it out, but they would have somebody coming out carrying a placard with a number, usually seven figures, preparing for retirement. Well, it'd be nice to have a seven-figure savings for retirement, but is it realistic for most people? I don't think so. And yet I would encourage everyone to plan and prepare, but there really are things that matter more. I have always operated on the premise that if we follow God and God's word, God has promised always to meet our needs. This seems to me to be at the very core of Matthew 6, the heart of the Sermon on the Mount. Seek first the kingdom and righteousness and all these things. And if you look at the context, the things that are mentioned there are food, shelter, and raiment. That's about all any of us actually need. And Jesus assures us when we prioritize life the way God intended it, then the things we need, God will provide. In fact, the psalmist said, I've been young and now old. One thing I have not seen, the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. The problem today is not that people, by and large, lack necessities. It is that they want way more than what is necessary. There's an old proverb that essentially says, to make a person happy, do not add to their possessions, but decrease their desires. And though that's not a biblical quotation, it is certainly a biblical principle. The point of all of this is to say, folks, that the world's got it wrong, but the Word has it right, and there is nothing more pressing, more urgent than our preparation or being ready for eternity. And I share that with you with the assumption that you understand that there are really three very serious problems that need to be addressed before it's too late. And the first is the danger of death. And we don't like to contemplate it. We don't like to talk about it. But the reality is that if time continues, that's the fate of all of us. When I read Genesis 5, what strikes me as I read that narrative, that fifth chapter with the genealogical record that begins at Adam and concludes with Noah, is that repetitive phrase found seven or eight times within that one chapter, beginning with Adam, and all the days of Adam were 930 years, and he died. The only exception in that entire chapter is Enoch, who walked with God and was not because God took him. I'm reasonably confident that we're not going to be an exception. That if God allows this world to stand, death is in our future. And from a Christian perspective, and the passage Lonnie read for us this evening from 2 Timothy 4 really highlights this, that's not a terribly frightening thing. In fact, from a Christian perspective, it's something that we can anticipate, eagerly anticipate. When he wrote to the Philippians, Paul said, I'm in a strait betwixt two. I have a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better, and yet it's more needful for your sakes that I remain. That ought to be the attitude of every Christian. In Ecclesiastes 3, 1 and 2, Solomon said, there is a time and a purpose, a season and time for every purpose under heaven. There is a time to be born and a time to die. And we all understand that. And we never know what time it is. Because the old must die and the young clearly may. And every day is a gift from God to be used. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 2 simply observes, better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. The end of all men is the house of mourning. And if you're wise and understand it, you'll do something about it and make preparation. Most folks can quote Hebrews 9:27, "It's appointed unto men once to die, but after this, the judgment." We know the verse, but do we live with a proper understanding and therefore application of it? We just recently were studying from Genesis 27, and we encountered an interaction between Isaac and his son Esau, in which Isaac dispatches Esau into the woods to find venison, prepare it, and serve him a meal that he really delighted in. Isaac's old. And he says in the context of that interaction in verses 1 and 2, "I know not the day of my death." He would soon offer his blessing upon his son. He thought Esau, and he wanted to get it done before death came calling, because he knew that it was getting nearer with the passing of every day. There are some things that are so urgent and so important that you can't delay them too long, or the consequences can be disastrous. Can we not all say, as did Isaac, "I know not the day of my death"? Because we don't. A man by the name of Warwick is said to have made this observation: "There is nothing in life so certain as death, and nothing so uncertain as the time of dying." Life is precious and precarious. When David was talking with his dear friend Jonathan, it's going to be necessary for David to flee from Saul and to separate from his best friend Jonathan. And they're talking about this, and David is acknowledging Jonathan didn't want to believe it, but Saul intended for David to die. And he made attempt after attempt, and it was hard for Jonathan to believe that his father would do that, because David was, in fact, his most trusted general. But as David explains the necessity to get out of Dodge, as we would say today, he said to Jonathan, "There is but a step between me and death." I don't know if you're familiar with that statement in 1 Samuel 20, verse 3 or not, but I think about it a lot when I'm on the highway. And I watch the way people drive. And there's often just a few feet to a few inches between life and death. Some people seem not to understand that. I know they don't understand it because they drive like idiots. In and out of traffic at 20, 30 miles over the speed limit. For what reason? What purpose? To get somewhere a couple of minutes quicker, putting their lives and the lives of many others in danger in the process. The fact of the matter is, there is but a step between us and death as well. James said, and most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with these words in chapter 4, when he asked the question, "What is your life?" "It's a vapor, a puff of smoke that appears for a little while and then vanishes away." And then in the only psalm attributed to Moses, the 90th psalm, Moses makes this observation: "The days of our years are 70." That's the fancy way of saying 70. "And if by reason of strength, before 80, they're soon cut off and we fly away." And then he says, "We spend our lives as a tale that is told." A short story at best. And that's for one who lives 70, 80 or more years. And a lot of folks are not fortunate enough to live nearly that long. And we don't know. None of us do. So it seems to me that we must recognize the urgency of obeying Jesus and being faithful disciples with the understanding that the clock is ticking and death may come for any of us at any time. Not a single one of us in this assembly has a guarantee to see the sun tomorrow morning. And I don't say that, again, to be morbid or really to frighten you, because from a Christian perspective, I don't believe it's a bad thing. I believe what would really be tragic is not to be able to die, to just simply grow old and older and even older. Death is a release. Paul calls it is analusis in our text here in 2 Timothy chapter 4 from verses 6 through 8. It's the time of my departure, he said. And that word is just a beautiful word in the original. And someday, God willing, we may spend some time just in verses 6, 7, and 8 in what he's actually saying here. There's no fear. There's no dread. There's nothing associated with Paul's death, from Paul's perspective, that the world would understand. The Christians understand it, because Paul knew that with his death, he moved on and up to a better place. That's what we all know, because that passage closes with the assurance that Paul had a place reserved for him, a crown. And the word is Stephanos, the victor's crown, not diadem, the ruler's crown. And he says, it's not for me only, but to all them that love his appearing. So, if you understand just how brief and uncertain life is, you'll get ready for death. And understand in the process that it holds so much for God's people. For when our earthly house of this tabernacle is dissolved, Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Are you ready for death? Because it's coming. It's urgent that we be ready because of how dangerous sin actually is. It's because of sin that it was necessary for Christ to leave heaven and come into this world. God commended his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us, wrote the Apostle Paul to the church at Rome. It was an act of love and sacrifice, because all are condemned because of sin and hopeless and helpless to remedy the situation on their own. So God provides the remedy, but men must accept it and obey Jesus. And the longer we delay, the harder it becomes. The Bible uses three illustrations of what happens when people do not consider the seriousness of sin and the urgency of dealing with it while they can. From the Hebrews epistle in chapter 3, verse 12 and verse 13, you have this writer speaking about the nature of sin, the deceitfulness of sin, and how it hardens hearts. You see, sin can become so much a part of our lives that our hearts just are hardened to truth and righteousness, and the gospel of Jesus Christ loses its appeal. And the more one delays, the more likely one's heart will be hardened. Another illustration that is used is found in 1 Timothy chapter 4, 1 through 4, when Paul warns Timothy of those whose consciences have been seared by hot iron. The conscience can become, we would use probably the term today, calloused. So calloused that nothing good and right and proper can penetrate. How can that happen? By refusing to acknowledge the serious nature of sin and accepting the only remedy that is available in the person of Jesus Christ. And then there's this third illustration that I find really striking from the Ephesian letter, in Ephesians 4:19, where the text speaks of those who were past feeling. People can actually reach a point in their lives, if they're not careful, when they just don't feel anymore. The tears will not stain the cheeks. The heart is not soft and pliable to the needs and wants and hurts of others around them. And one of the hallmarks of New Testament Christianity, according to Romans chapter 12, is the ability to weep with those that weep and to rejoice with those that rejoice. But folks, we've got to be able to feel to do that. And the more we turn away from Christ and His gospel, the more likely it is that our heart's going to be hardened, that our conscience is going to be seared, and we will become past feeling. You can't let that happen, because when it does, there's no return. That's another lesson, if you recall, we learned from the Hebrews letter, that you can reach a point of no return when the gospel no longer has any appeal. The story of Christ does not move you. His death, burial, and resurrection has no impact on your heart, because it's hardened and your conscience is seared and your past feeling. Don't let it happen. And folks will say, well, I would never let that happen. But then it does, because they delay and delay and delay, like Felix, looking for a convenient season which never comes. So, death may strike. Are you ready? The gospel calls. Is your heart soft? Is your conscience malleable? Are you able to feel and experience that emotional story of God's love manifested through God's Son at Calvary? But there is a third possibility that ought to, I believe, encourage everyone to prepare, now, not later. And that's the real possibility that Jesus Christ may come at any time. I don't know when the Lord will return, and I do know that those who claim to know are not being honest, because Jesus, in the course of His ministry, didn't know. And He made that abundantly clear in Matthew's gospel, the 24th chapter. He likened His second coming to the thief in the night. Thieves do not send out advance notice. The Apostle Paul uses that same analogy in his letter to the church at Thessalonica. The Apostle Peter uses it in 2 Peter chapter 3. The coming of the Lord will be like the thief in the night. And twice in Revelation, John uses that same analogy to say Jesus is coming. And we don't know when. But if we're ready, it doesn't matter. And by the way, the second coming of Christ is either stated directly or implied 300 plus times in the New Testament. Now think about that for a moment. 300 plus times. He is coming. Now the tendency is to say, but He hasn't, so He's not. We have a warning from Peter about that very idea. All things continue as they have from the beginning, and He hasn't come. He's not coming. But remember, the Lord does not measure things as we do. One day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Why hasn't He come? The Lord is not slack concerning His promise, but He is long-suffering, patient, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. As long as there is hope that mankind can be redeemed, God's Son will remain in heaven. But the time is coming. And I know not when, because I cannot measure the patience of God, nor truly know the hearts of men, but the time is coming when the days will be like the days of Noah, when the imagination of man's heart was on evil continually, when violence filled the land, and God will say enough, and Jesus will return in the air. He will never set foot on this globe again, contrary to our premillennial friends. The earth and the works therein shall be burned up, Peter said, and all of these things shall be dissolved. That being the case, what kind of person ought we to be? And the answer is godly, holy, righteous children of God, disciples of Christ, men and women prepared for the coming of Jesus. He said, "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go and prepare a place for you, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also." You can count on it. He always keeps his word. He honors every promise. And if we're ready, there really is a great day coming, isn't there? But if we aren't, it's a different story altogether. So, are you ready? Are you ready? When death comes, opportunities cease. When the heart is hardened, the conscience seared, and man becomes past feeling, the gospel will lose its appeal. And if Jesus comes and finds you unprepared, he will have no recourse but to honor your choice in this life for eternity and say, "Depart, I never knew you, ye that work iniquity." And the choice is ours. I suspect, as I look into your faces tonight, that you all are ready. But you know people who aren't. And God really is counting on all of us to do what we can to reach the lost with the message of Christ while they can still obey it. So look at your own heart and life. Make sure that you're where you ought to be spiritually. And then walk out of here this evening determined to do anything and everything within the framework of God's wonderful book to encourage others to make the choice that you have made and walk in the steps of Jesus. If we can help you toward that end, you just need to make your wishes known as we stand together and sing.